Good morning, good people. This is Kiplin Primus, your host for the local take on Jazz 91.9 WCLK. And this morning, we are having our political roundtable. We are joined in the studio by Eunice Cho from the Southern Poverty Law Center. Eunice, welcome.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And our regular political commentator, Dr. William Boone, political science professor at Clark Atlanta University.
Hello. Always good to be back.
Glad you're here, Dr. Boone. So we're starting this morning with the Supreme Court's decisions. They just had a flurry of decisions come out. And one of the ones that was a 4-4 decision was on the affirmative action case at the University of Texas. And with that 4-4 decision, it means that affirmative action has been upheld. Dr. Boone, what do you think about this 4-4 court?
Well, the 4-4 court is very interesting. And actually, what it does is gives the moderates, or so-called swing votes on the court, an opportunity to make some very good decisions. Good decisions, let's put it this way, to be the deciding voices in these decisions. When you had Scalia and Thomas and a couple of others, it seemed to be swinging on the conservative side. But 4-4 makes Kennedy a very prominent voice and a very important voice on the court.
And I was mistaken, the affirmative action case was actually 4-3.
4-3. Yeah.
And so I think this is one of the first times I remember affirmative action actually being upheld by this court in quite some time.
Yeah, it's been a while, but you know, this Texas case has been to the court on several other occasions, and on each occasion it come out okay. This court has been somewhat reluctant to interfere in these cases in terms of affirmative action, and has leaned more towards what some would consider the more conservative side and not to use race. As a matter of fact, this court, I think that Ms. Chow will probably, hopefully she would agree, that this court has looked, we talk about using race as a criteria, as part of the criteria, a very high scrutiny is probably used in terms of deciding that. As a matter of fact, this court seems to be thinking that we're all a colorblind society.
Well, I think the interesting thing about this case, and the plaintiff was Abby Fisher, and she was not declined. She was accepted at a later start date. And the people that were accepted over her, it was a mix. I think there were only 4 African-American students who were actually accepted over her. So she was really kind of battling the other white applicants in all actuality.
Yeah, that's true, because quite frankly, in terms, there are other white folk who returned down who had higher scores
than she did.
And then when one looks at the policy that Texas has tried to put in place, they are attempting to bring in a diverse group of folk. But also, Texas has a law that allows the top 10% or the valedictorians of the Texas high schools to come in. You know, and that's an idea of bringing in more diversity. And the court agrees that the Texas law as it relates to race is one among several criteria.
Yeah.
So it's not just the only criteria. And the idea is you want to make a diverse kind of population in your educational institutions. And this is one way of doing that. And so the burden, of course, was on Texas to show this, and it showed it to the satisfaction of the majority of the court. Now, the court's dissenters argued just the opposite, that the state of Texas did not prove that this was something they had to do and that race was necessary in order to reach a certain goal.
And I think that the total African-American population at the University of Texas in Austin is under 5%.
Under 5%, yeah.
Even with the affirmative action admission, so to speak.
Yes, it is. As a matter of fact, this case is not unlike other cases, especially in graduate schools. And I think at one point the court, several years ago, actually several terms ago, was interested in talking about trying to make law, the professional law, so we're really talking about here, a more diverse profession, because these jurists understand that predominance of white conservative judges on the court generally means that folk, no matter how much they try to be self-conscious about their own biases, they creep into decisions.
They do. And that next decision on immigration, that was a 4-4 decision. And basically what that decision said was that the executive order by President Obama to expand the DREAM Act, so to speak, cannot be permitted.
That's right.
And Eunice, could you share just a little bit? Because it really kind of leaves some people in limbo now.
Well, this decision leaves about 3.9 million people in the country without relief. The Obama administration a few years ago actually implemented two programs. One was called Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Part 2 and Deferred Actions for Parents of American. And what this program did was to permit undocumented people who had children in the United States who are U.S. citizens or individuals who had been here for a very long time, who had arrived as children, had been educated in the United States, to basically have relief and from the fear of being deported and also have work authorization, so permission to work in the United States. This was going to help 3.9 million people here in the United States. Actually, over 120,000 people here in Georgia were estimated to have benefit from the program. What happened is that the 26 state governments, including the state of Georgia, actually specifically picked one judge in the state of Texas who is known to be incredibly anti-immigrant to challenge President Obama's policy, basically challenging President Obama's authority as president to enact this policy. What it has done is it's gone up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court basically split 4-4 evenly and issued a one-sentence decision. It did not go into the merits of the decision at all. It just said that we basically can't come to an agreement on this case, so it's going to go back down to the district court.
That's a good point about the fact that the merits of this have yet to be decided. We're talking about the injunction not to enforce. That's key here because what you're talking about, I think you're absolutely right. What you're talking about is a challenge to presidential authority in certain areas. We're talking about the area of the borders and whether or not a state can go ahead and preempt, quite frankly, the Congress or the federal government as it comes to border protection.
The thing that just strikes me about this is that even if you are anti-immigrant, this is a way that those people you're against come out of the shadows. And wouldn't that be better for everyone? Because then those people are paying taxes. They've got the right to work, but they're paying taxes on money. That's one of the things that people are against. The immigrants are coming, they're taking our jobs, they don't pay taxes. But this would allow them to pay taxes. This would allow you to know 3.9 million people that are here and undocumented.
That's right. I think one of the benefits of having people who are actually able to work, you know, with permission, it's not as if these folks are not already working and several of them are already paying taxes. The thing is that this would allow people to do it on the books. It would also keep unscrupulous employers who are hiring people under the table, paying people sub-minimum wages, to actually require to have some leverage, say, no, you need to follow labor laws. This helps everybody. It raises the boats for everyone. And not only that, it really protects families from being separated. We know countless stories of children who were born here in the United States who end up in foster care because their parents are deported. And over 40,000 Georgian U.S. citizen children have actually lost their parents in the last 5 years as a result of that. So it is a real impact that is happening in here in our community.
And Eunice, doesn't that end up costing us more?
That's right. I think everyone would agree it would be better off for kids to be with their parents and not be dependent on the state.
That's correct. You know, it's kind of disingenuous sometimes, the arguments being put forward and the anti-immigration arguments, especially when it comes from people in the American South who make use of immigrant labor and pay themselves wages. And for those folk who indicate the fact that these immigrants are taking away American jobs, it's because they cannot come out of shadows and be paid on regular labor laws, which then would force employers to go out and get a little competition in terms of wages. But if I can pay you less, then I'm going to do it. And that happens all across the country.
I think people are just not thinking some of these things through. So this is Kiplin Primus, your host for The Local Take. We're talking with Eunice Cho from the Southern Poverty Law Center and Dr. William Boone, political science professor at Clark Atlanta University. So one of the other court decisions these last few days was to strike down the Texas abortion restrictions. And those restrictions, they're called the trap laws, making doctors who perform abortions get admitting rights, making them turn the clinics into surgical centers, where medical, there's no medical need for any of those things. And quite frankly, I think it was very important that we had three women on the Supreme Court who could actually speak for women, because these laws handicap women more than anyone else. The 24-hour waiting period, if you don't have an abortion clinic in your neighborhood and you've got to drive miles to it, then not only do you have to drive miles to it, you've got to wait 24 hours. It just really does put an undue burden on women. So are we finally going to see some light now on abortion restrictions in the country?
Well, one would hope so, but I'm not quite sure. You know, you're right about the Texas law was just outrageous, and it had no benefit to women. I mean, there was no benefit at all. As a matter of fact, just the opposite would occur in terms of what the kind of restrictions that were placed on these clinics that offered those particular services to women. And it was a thinly veiled disguise in terms of trying to say, listen, we're going to try to outlaw abortions in spite of the Roe case, the 1973 case. That's what it was all about. So the politics are very, very heavy here. And a succession of devices have been put in place by various states with the aid of anti-abortion groups. So I don't think you've seen the end of this. I don't think you've seen the end of it at all. Because remember, there's still some states that hold to the fact that individuals, women must witness or see a videotape of a birth, you know, of an abortion. You must go and wait in some states still 24 hours. All these regulations are still in place in some areas. Now, since the court has ruled, it certainly does make them think twice about certain overly burdensome, at least seemingly overly burdensome things. But the politics are there. And as long as this is an open question about whether or not a woman has a right to decide whether or not she's going to carry a fetus to term, it's going to be a question. It's going to be a question. But you're right. Luckily, Kagan and the other folk were there.
Well, there are 26 other states that have similar laws.
Yes.
So now how does that decision, will that decision impact those states?
I think this is a hugely important decision for reproductive justice for women around the country, not just in Texas. I think we saw the immediate impact of what happened when this law was passed in Texas, which basically made reproductive rights services unavailable for the vast majority of women in Texas, the majority of whom were women of color, low-income women in general. And I think, as you said earlier, it was a huge victory for the reproductive justice movement. And it was interesting to see how the three women justices on the Supreme Court really took control of that oral argument. And, you know, they even pushed the oral argument past time because they were grilling the government lawyer so hard about the justifications for this policy. One of the things that came up was Texas required women to, if they were going to be taking medication in order to have the abortion, they would have to make repeat visits to take the pill in the doctor's office in order to do so. And as you mentioned earlier, this is just a ridiculous restriction in terms of women, especially for women who have to travel far distances, have to take off time from work, and may not have access to transportation.
And Eunice, one of the things that you said were these laws were targeting low income and women of color, because women who have means have never had lack of access for reproductive rights.
That's right. I mean, I think that we know that the brunt of these restrictive laws really do fall on, you know, low income women and women of color who don't have the same type of access to health care or, you know, other forms of transportation or access to care. So these types of laws really do have the greatest impact on those women.
And one last thing on the Supreme Court was the law for people who have been convicted of domestic violence can no longer have access to buy guns.
Yeah.
Who saw that one coming?
I found an extraordinary decision by them. Surprising somewhat, too, and given the Heller decision some years ago that allowed, you know, you had this kind of unbridled constitutional right. And I think scholars are still, you know, I look at this and say, look, the reading of the Second Amendment to the U.S. Constitution is somewhat interesting as portrayed by the conservatives, as led by Scalia, because it decontextualized the whole Second Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. That amendment, quite frankly, was was fashioned during a period, number one, when you didn't have organized militia, and there were state militias, but you did not have really organized militia. Secondly, the country was somewhat in a state of, let's put it this way, the law enforcement was somewhat less reliable. And there were a good many things, and it was written in order as a defense mechanism for the country, not necessarily for individuals to go around and just purchase a weapon at will, any kind of weapon. So it's decontextualized. So one does not have that kind of unbridled, unlimited access to a gun. Think of it this way. When one looks at the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, although people think they have unlimited right to speak, the court has said time and time again that the freedom of speech is somewhat limited. So one could argue that the Second Amendment could certainly come under that same kind of scrutiny in terms of the limitations placed on it.
Well, that's pretty much the Supreme Court for the last few weeks, and we'll see how long we stay with the 8-person court. That is unprecedented.
Yes, it is. Well, you know, usually the Congress, or in particular the Senate, will do its job, will do its duty, and at least hold hearings on the nominee of the president.
Even if they were going to turn him down, they would go through the motions.
Yeah, but I think they would. This is really indicative of the great divide in this country and the amount of partisanship, and that just infuses American politics. And it really acts as a barrier to real rational government at this point.
Well, let's bring it home a little bit closer to home with the Latino population in Georgia growing exponentially. I think in Gwinnett County will be more than 50% Latino citizens in the next 4 or 5 years. The metro area has attracted quite a few Latinos. I think we're the 10th with the number of Latino residents in our state. Can that Latino population turn Georgia at least purple? Do you think this year might be the year?
Well, I think this may not be the year. I think statistics really do show that we haven't quite hit the tipping point. But I do think that this is something that all of us, both folks in the community, that local politicians, that our legislators really need to be aware of, especially when considering policies that affect Latino communities, including anti-immigrant policies. We know that in places like you mentioned, Gwinnett County have actually been some of the most anti-immigrant localities around the state. And especially with a growing number of Latinos, I think that the policymakers in those areas will really need to start being responsive to those changes, because they may find themselves being replaced by other elected officials. We've seen these types of changes happening all over the state, and I think especially as U.S. citizen children who are of Latino descent, U.S. citizen children of Asian descent in particular, as these folks start to become voting age, these are incredibly politicized folks, especially in light of some of the attacks that have happened against immigrant communities. And so there is quite a huge wave of folks who are coming up, who are growing up, being plugged into the community and are aware of the importance of voting. And so this is something that legislators really should be aware of.
I think, you know, we talk about the actual numbers of Latino voters, and I think we should also talk about turnout as well. And turnout is very important, because within the African-American community, turnout has increased steadily since the 2000. In fact, even a little before that. So I suspect with Latino voters, you're going to see that same kind of increase. And within certain areas and certain parts of the state of Georgia, you probably will find some politicians feeling these Latino voters coming to the polls. And as Eunice has said here, to address certain specific questions and issues related to the Latino community. You can see that even creeping, or did creep into the state Republican folk discussion at one point. Not as much now, but at one point it was creeping up there, because they did see that happening. As a matter of fact, that you had some African-Americans complaining that they were paying more attention to Latino voters than they were paying to the traditional African-American vote. But on a more serious note, I agree with you. It will not happen this year necessarily. But of course, now, this is a very interesting election year. I mean, you know, the Electoral College is what decides who becomes president. And it's a plurality of votes that one has to get in order to achieve the electoral votes, not necessarily a majority. So never can tell.
Well, I think one of the things Eunice mentioned about policy, and, you know, we're still under those laws that prohibit Latina students who are undocumented, but they've been brought to the country 2 or 3 years old. We've educated them elementary, high school, but valedictorians can't go to the University of Georgia. And really what you're losing is it's a brain drain, because when those students leave this state, the chances of them coming back and contributing decrease.
I think it's a really it's a policy that Georgia really will need to reconsider, because not only does it have implications for Georgia's economy, like you said, we're losing hundreds of very talented students every year. You also it's a structural thing where you have a whole category of mostly Latino Asian students who can't go to school because of this discriminatory ban against enrollment, which I have to say, Georgia, South Carolina, and Alabama are the only three states in the country that have this sort of ban. So I don't know if we really want to be in following those types of precedents, especially given Georgia's leading role in the economy in the region.
Right. You know, it's interesting, too, because I think sometimes we back away from what's really driving these kinds of policies and individuals' feelings. I mean, we should be very clear about this. It's a combination of xenophobia and a combination of racism in terms of this. And folks feel that these are the others and you're taking away America from us. And I think it certainly comes out during this present run-up to the presidential election in terms of how folks are beginning to sort of put a certain kind of narrative on they want their country back. Yeah, so that's the question, too. I think,
and that goes to education, because yes, Latinos have been in our state from the very beginning. They have contributed to the growth of the state legally and as immigrants.
Yeah, and I think in so-called Native Americans was talking about the Trail of Tears, rather. But yeah, there have been folk here other than Europeans long before, especially here in Georgia.
Especially in Georgia. I mean, where Ponce de Leon came first, they were in St. Augustine. It wasn't that far from our state lines. I mean, the Latino...
As folks just tell me, people were not lost. They were not found.
Yes, they've been here all along. I think that's amazing. But Dr. Boone, you brought up the presidential election, and the conventions are coming up. I mean, we will know, you know, the crownings will take place in the next couple of weeks. The Republican convention is July 18th through 21st in Cleveland. I don't know if you all saw, but George Will, prominent conservative Republican columnist, has said that he has changed his affiliation from Republican to unaffiliated. You've got corporate sponsors saying they're not going to go to Cleveland. The Bush dynasty, the whole family, has said, you know, Papa Bush, George Bush, Jeff, none of that family will be there. Is this the beginning of the end of the old Republican Party? Is it going to be something new, or is it going to fracture? What's really going to happen here?
Well, clearly the Republican Party that you knew prior to the last 8 or 9 months is over. I mean, I think it wouldn't take anyone with any deep political knowledge to recognize that. But seriously, it is over. It is fractured. The Republican Party has been flirting with this kind of thing for at least 20 plus years. And by that, I mean they have been catering to a certain element within the American society, and they've been playing them. One can talk about the religious right, one can talk about the Tea Party, but even prior to that. And you had this sort of catering and pandering to that particular group. And now that particular group, that far right wing, has now come home. So the chickens sort of coming home to roost, so to speak. And that's why you're getting a splinter in the party. And the fear that the Republican mainstream, so-called mainstream leadership had, is manifested in the U.S. Congress. Remember, when the Tea Party supporters became members of the U.S. House in particular, they frustrated the leadership, and the leadership seemed to be frightened of them. All of these things are now beginning to come home to roost. And what you get is a Donald Trump who comes in at just the right time for him to capitalize on that, and the whole business of America itself, not only in the United States, but the world at large, the inequalities amongst group is growing so huge and so large, and that now you see it being manifested, and in the populist movement, in fact, both on the right and the left, are beginning to show their heads, and Trump has capitalized on that, as did Bernie Sanders, as a matter of fact, for the left. So it's going to be an interesting kind of race. So the Republican Party, yes, as you know it, is pretty much gone. It's going to reorganize in a different kind of way, maybe not immediately after this election, but certainly move in that direction for the next 4.5 years.
Well, Dr. Boone, honest and truthfully, I thought I was overreaching there, because I remember when Rince Priebus, chairman of the Republican Party, said how much outreach they were going to be doing to the Latino community, to the Asian community, to the African American community. So did they actually try, or did how do you make that kind of decision and then we end up where we are today?
Well, I think, you know, definitely the Republican Party in the last election, there was a concerted strategy to try to recruit more quote unquote diverse Republicans to the party. So there was an attempt to try to draft Latino, African American, Asian American folks into the party. But I think, as Doctor said, the rise of Trump and the rhetoric even alone is enough to tell folks that perhaps the Republican Party wasn't quite as earnest about its intentions in the first place. And I think, you know, we see that in the result in the polling. We know that voters of color are uniformly against, in overwhelming majority, are uniformly against the Republican Party at this point, in large part to a lot of the very incendiary rhetoric that has come out of the Trump camp.
Yeah, but I think you'll be very careful about overstating, not that you're overstating the Republicans' effort in terms of trying to bring into their tent Latino people, Asian folk, and African-Americans. Now, that attempt, and in fact, it goes back to something called the 21. It goes back quite a ways. Mm-hmm. But that attempt was somewhat less than full-throated. By that, I mean, the Republicans would say to you, yes, come to us, but when you come to us, you must change and not us. And I think that is key here. What they said to these groups were that what you're talking about is all wrong, just come to us, and we'll do better for you regardless. But your particular viewpoints are not the viewpoints, and your particular issues and the way you want to move in your issues or mold those issues are not the way that we want to move. So it's less than a full-throated kind of thing. So the results they got was what you see now.
And the Democratic Convention is the week after, July 25th through 28th in Philadelphia. And the most recent polls have put Hillary Clinton up over Trump by about 12 percentage points. Is this her election to lose? The last Benghazi report, I guess. I think it'll be the last Benghazi report came out and found no fault. Are we going to have a woman president?
I always tell folks, we political scientists do not predict. We simply tell you, right? I don't know, but I do know. You're right. This most recent report that comes out of the House of the Congress, found nothing different than was already known. It's just a repeat of what was already there, all 800 pages, just a repeat of what's already there. But much more importantly here, in terms of whether or not you're going to have a president who's female or woman, is interesting because the Democrats have a problem, too. It's a problem that's less discussed than that of the Republicans. And that is a problem of whether or not Clinton and the other folk can turn out the black vote. And I'll be on, and very specific, can they turn the African-American vote out? Because without the African-American vote, they're on very thin ice in terms of trying to turn some of these states, especially those so-called states that lean one way or the other. States are in play. And within that group of African-American voters, we're talking more specifically about African-American women, quite frankly, and a cohort of young voters as well. Those are the folk who the Clinton folk need to turn out. And a significant number of them, as you well know, other than African-American women, went to Bernie Sanders. So there's a problem.
We actually have quite a few young African-American activists saying that they are not going to vote in protest. And there was one quote from a young woman on an NPR story. I think she was 36 years old, 32 years old, and talked about the fact, you know, that I voted every year since I was 18, and it doesn't matter who gets into office, I'm still struggling.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is not an uncommon feeling amongst many young voters. I think that there is a disillusionment with the traditional types of political engagement, including voter turnout, organizing for electoral campaigns, where the organizing really is happening, and I think in a very clear and impactful way, is in places where people are really organizing around specific issues that impact local communities. We see the rise of groups like Black Lives Matter. We see Not One More, the anti-deportation campaigns, where young people are really engaging and engaging in some very direct types of organizing activism at the community level, but with a broader vision around social justice. And I think that there is, I think, quite a disconnect at times between those types of activism activism and what's happening in these electoral campaigns? I think the answer really is for folks who are running for electoral office to be able to actually make themselves relevant to folks who are really working on these types of deeply engaged issues in matters that are very important to the community.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right there, because you do see that happening, but there seems to be a kind of idea that is either or. You know, either I'm going to organize at the local community, organize, mobilize at the local level, or I got to vote in a national election. It doesn't seem to me that that's the best approach. I mean, certainly, I mean, one comes out of the 1960s, one believes in organizing and mobilizing, but certainly one should use every available tool that one has. And organizing at the local level and issues is very good. And I think you're absolutely right, because one of the things that we could critique the Obama folk about in terms of when they organized and run up to 2008 election was the fact that when they organized, they did not do a very good job of leaving in place or trying to inspire or help folk at the local level organize around those very local issues that you're talking about. And that would have kept every organization viable through time.
That would have helped those midterms.
And midterm elections, yeah, as opposed to organizing for change. And one of the things politicians always do, it seems to me, is overpromise. It's not going to happen in 4 or 8 years. And when you overpromise, you really get people upset when you don't deliver.
This is Kiplin Primus, your host for The Local Take. We're talking with Eunice Cho from the Southern Poverty Law Center and Dr. William Boone, political science professor at Clark Atlanta University. Now, one of the things that has kind of come up over and over and over again is that voting. And I've even said to some of the young folks on Twitter who are saying they're not voting for president, I would rather you vote for Trump, vote for the Libertarian, write in a candidate, don't not vote. And, you know, we've heard about people who come in and vote for the president and don't vote for the down ballot. And these folks are kind of saying they're going to vote for the down ballot and not vote for president. But how do we continue to emphasize how important it is for people to vote?
Well, you know, as I said earlier, voting certainly is just one thing you should do. I think you should combine the voting with actions that you want to take. You should combine voting with accountability. There's many things you can do with voting. There should not be the expectation that the casting of a ballot for a certain candidate is going to bring about a miracle. It should not be tied to that. And there seems to be within the American psyche or the American kind of narrative that indeed the voting is going to bring about all these changes. If you do not vote, then these changes will not come. Now, you can vote, and as people, it's been demonstrated, the change will not come. That's because you are not doing the things necessary to follow up on that vote. The vote is only one element in a whole plethora of things that you got to do to make sure that vote really counts. It counts twice. It counts when they add them up, but it also counts when you go back to the politician and say, look, this is what you did not do. We're talking about accountability. And that's a minor thing, but that does not discount organizing and pushing at the local level.
I think the other thing that goes with encouraging people to vote is that we do have a policy in Georgia that actually can actively lead people to not vote. I think there's a number of policies here in Georgia that make it very difficult first to register to vote. There are continuous attempts to make it more difficult and more challenging to vote, taking away early voting, for example, or trying to cut back on, increase requirements to actually vote themselves. So not only do we have the question of how do we encourage people to vote, we also have to look at some of the systemic, attempts by folks to actually erode the right to vote and make it more challenging. And we can look at the example of other states that have actually gone out of their way to make it much more easy to vote, including day of registration, early balloting, you know, all these types of things that do make it easier for everybody to participate.
I think it's Oregon that has the mail-in vote. So
that's right.
You get your ballot, you mail it in, it's easy.
Yes, right. You know, and you're right. I mean, the whole idea, you know, I guess there must be some folk at some level who believe there's something to voting because of the number of laws that have been enacted to try to suppress and to make voting a little less inclusive and more exclusive. You sort of tip up on the idea of ID laws, which would be very restrictive, They have been restrictive. And the court, this court, this U.S. Supreme Court, has gone along with these ID laws. I mean, thinking that it's not overly burdensome on various populations within the country. So there are people who think that voting does do something.
Or
so
they wouldn't try to take it away.
Yeah, I mean, that is kind of a common sense kind of argument, I guess. But, you know, yeah, that is the kind of thing we can talk about. But you're right. There are people who are out there who are actually attempting to take away that particular right.
Limited.
Yeah. If they could, they were limited and they would take it away, but certainly limited and make it very extremely difficult for you to vote. I mean, one talks about ex-felons, you know,
right.
People who have paid their price, whatever price you asked me to pay for committing some transgression I paid. And now you tell me that my right, which of course brings in the question whether or not voting is a right or a privilege, was another question. I cannot vote, you know, it makes a difference. State of Texas, you have to wait 5 years to even apply after you've committed the crime, you know.
Well, I'm going to do a shout out for the primary runoffs in Georgia. That voting day is July 26th, and the early voting for that starts July 5th. And if people don't show up for primary elections and, you know, off presidential elections, runoffs, 9%, I think, is a good turn up for runoff elections.
You'll be lucky, right?
But July 5th, early voting starts for all of the runoff elections. Eunice, I want to thank you so much for coming. And one of the things that I definitely wanted you to share, we have talked about the school, the prison pipeline, the cradle of prison pipeline, but you talked to me about the deportation to prison pipeline, which I had no idea that this was also part of this prison culture that we're living in.
That's right. I mean, we are concerned with what is happening to folks who are not citizens in the United States and what is happening with the criminalization of these communities. And like you said, we call it the prison to deportation pipeline, where there is a system that is actually even more severe for people who are not citizens, because even after folks have been charged or have served their time in the criminal justice system, if you're not a citizen of the United States, you are then transferred into what we call the immigration detention and deportation system. And one thing that we're really concerned about is, at least here in Georgia, there are thousands of people who are affected by these types of policies every day. I think something that people don't really know is that immigration enforcement is actually the largest amount of federal enforcement, law enforcement. It's bigger than all of the other federal law enforcement agencies combined. And the U.S. government actually detains over 440,000 people in the United States every year. This is a huge increase, because if you look back at 1996, it was 6,000 people. We're now at 440,000 people. So, you know, what happened since 1996? We had a bunch of anti-immigrant laws passed actually at the very same time that we saw the growth of what we call the prison industrial complex. So the growth is very much the same. One of the things that people don't really know is that over 62% of the facilities that house immigrant detainees are private. So there are privately owned prisons, and there is definitely a profit incentive to keep people locked up. We also spend about $2 billion every year locking immigrant detainees up. And much of that money, as I said earlier, are going to private prison companies. One of the things that I really want folks to know about is that non-citizen immigrants who, you know, might get pulled over at a traffic stop. And we know that in many communities in Georgia, for example, Latinos, Asians, folks who are perceived to be not citizens actually get targeted for law enforcement disproportionately than the community. This is very similar with African Americans, who are also targets of law enforcement. And one of the consequences that we've seen in places like Gwinnett County that I mentioned earlier is that we're often seeing people who get pulled over for things like a broken taillight, then getting asked about their immigration status, and then getting shuttled straight into the immigration deportation system. And what we're really trying to think about is, how is it that our local law enforcement agents are really becoming deputized and being used as the tool of the immigration deportation and detention system? So, I mean, you can get pulled over at a stop. then even if you don't get charged, you can still get transferred to immigration custody and get stuck in immigration detention and then ultimately deported. The one thing that I also like to talk about is the, not surprisingly, it's very difficult for people in immigration deportation proceedings to win their cases here. And there are a few really important numbers to think about. First of all, only 6% of people in immigration deportation proceedings have lawyers in the South. So that means 94% of people are going into these court proceedings without a lawyer. And if you can just imagine what that's like, especially if you don't speak English, that's an incredibly huge challenge. There was a recent article that came out in the Huffington Post that said Atlanta is one of the most unfriendly cities to undocumented immigrants. And they were looking specifically at the Atlanta immigration courts, where our immigration judges here in Atlanta, if you're applying for political asylum, their grant rate last year was 2%. So you have a 98% chance of losing your case before those judges. I want to contrast that to what's happening nationwide, which is if you have a 1 out of 2 chance, a 50% chance of winning nationwide. So we see that some of the judges here in Atlanta, not surprisingly, are exhibiting some signs of bias in terms of these types of cases. So these are all issues that we're very concerned with. You know, I think once we begin to peel away what is actually really happening systematically to non-citizens, to immigrants here in our community, it is something that we all need to be concerned about.
I thought Atlanta was the city too busy to hate.
Yeah, but you know, I think sometimes when you talk about Atlanta, you confuse Atlanta with Metro Atlanta. I mean, that's not necessarily what you're talking about here, but sometimes folk confuse Atlanta with Metro Atlanta because Gwinnett is a part of Metro Atlanta, right? Cobb is a part of Metro Atlanta.
Exactly.
And sometimes folks just simply use that large umbrella and say Atlanta, although there are problems in Atlanta's courts. There's no doubt about that.
And I do want to, you know, make a shout out to the city of Atlanta in general. I think, you know, there have been a lot of initiatives to try to make Atlanta a welcoming city. And one thing that we're really encouraged about is, for example, the creation of this pre-arrest diversion program, which really is trying to get folks who are very low-level offenders to keep people out of the criminal justice system and really give other types of support to people who are caught up in that. And I think it's been really exciting to be part of that process and to join this process as well, because I think it's really important to think about how these types of policing practices also affect people who are not citizens.
And they cost us so much money. And Eunice is talking about the LEAD program that is getting ready to be designed for Atlanta and Fulton County. And one of the judges gave an example of, you know, a homeless person, maybe some mental issues, in jail for 18 months just to determine if they're competent to stand trial. But that 18 months, it's about $60,000 to $90,000 just to keep someone who probably shouldn't be there. And that is no longer acceptable. I mean, the cities, states, and the municipalities really can't afford to do that.
Yeah, the sheer economics of it seem to be kind of counterproductive in terms of incarcerating people, especially homeless people, you know, who have a good many problems to deal with beyond the homelessness, you know, which sometimes is what generated the homelessness.
Well, I want to thank Eunice Chow from the Southern Poverty Law Center. And thank you, Dr. Boone, for giving us this political wrap-up for, what is this, the second quarter? we'll be back at the next quarter and see what's going on.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Mm.